Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all around the world. Diabolik offers one-stop shopping experience for all your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo, Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you are looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is owner-operated, small business choice you have been craving. Shop online today at DiabolikDVD.com.
It's 2020 and Fangoria magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fangoria editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table-worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much, much more. Go to Fangoria.com. Come and become a member today, and you can use your promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now.
Welcome to episode 173 of Shockwaves. I'm your co-host, Ryan Turek. To my left, I'm joined by Rebecca McKendry.
Hello!
And to my right, I have Mr. Robert Galuzzo.
Hey!
And Elric Kane.
Couch surfer. Thanks for your couch earlier.
No problem, bro.
What?
I was sleeping on his couch when I got
Elric here. Just walked in and he's like, I'm bushed. Do you have a couch? He's like, I do have a couch.
And then he totally crashed.
And then he totally knocked out.
Yeah. Did it.
Becca will post the photo up on Instagram.
Yeah, it totally creeped him. I walked in and Ryan goes, see who's asleep in the office, but don't wake the baby.
Don't
and I was
baby.
Expecting like an actual baby, and instead there's Elric on the couch. So
We need our naps.
Huh?
We need our power naps.
We do need power naps. I feel a lot better.
I miss power naps so bad.
Yeah. Anyways, back to the show. Tonight we welcome guest Spencer Charnas of the band Ice Nine Kills. The latest album, The Silver Scream, is a wall-to-wall trek-filled horror love letter to films like The Shining and Friday the 13th and Saw and Nightmare on Elm Street and Jaws and so on and so on. I had the good fortune to see them live before everybody broke for the Christmas holiday. And I got to tell you, the energy in that venue was incredibly infectious because I'd never seen Spencer play live. I had listened to the album quite a bit while I was on Halloween Kills, but it was an incredibly young crowd. Mm-hmm. I felt like the oldest one there. Yeah. And we were up in the balcony, and as soon as his riff on the Halloween theme kind of kicked in, every kid in the audience just erupted. There was just this roar that took over the entire venue.
Wow.
And he came out dressed as fucking the costumes that he's got. He's got like different. He goes through various costume changes. He puts on like a Jason mask. That's kind of a riff on that. Every once in a while, he'll have a performer come out. He's got like this kind of exorcist thing that happens. It's amazing. The show is incredible. He's an incredible showman. We had a great time. And I've gotten to know Spencer over the last month or so. And I just realized that he is a dyed-in-the-wool horror fan like all of us. And he's just one of those guys that translated that love of horror, much like the Boulé brothers last mm-hmm. week, translated it into a completely different medium, you know, than what we are accustomed to, you know, which is film and television. He just turned it into metal music.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. Yeah. I was unfamiliar until you mentioned that this guest was going to be on here, and I went through a deep dive into their latest album, but also their music videos. And he's got this like giant like arc through all the music videos where he's basically going to therapy for each thing that he's dealing with.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're at Crystal Lake in one, and then another one he turns into Pennywise the Clown, I guess.
Yeah,
pretty wild, you know, and he blames the psychiatrist. It's pretty wild. And I love that he's incorporating them all into the actual songs and stuff like that. I was never talented enough to do that as a musician.
To clip, like to take the tracks and actually turn it
in. No, they're like to like write a song about Camp Crystal Lake or Michael Myers. Like I was like heartbreak songs or whatever nonsense. But I remember I played CBGBs with my band when I was in high school, and our flyer was from Halloween 5. Like, we had no connection to Halloween 5. Yeah. I just loved my horror so much that I tried to make our ads into it, even though it had nothing to do with our band. So respect to Spencer for actually putting it into the music.
Makes it work. And every song is catchy as hell. You know, there's All Systems Go, the Jigsaw. I think that's the kind of hook to it. But I forgot what the name of the song is. But it's really, I mean, like, all of it is super, super.
The
Jig is Up.
Grave Mistake.
Grave Mistake. That was one of my things. Yeah.
I listened to it all day while I was in classes.
Yeah, so, there's just some really catchy, hooky thing songs in there, and you know, again, they're all just beautiful love letters to movies that we love. But first, before we have Spencer on, we have movies to talk about here.
Shockwaves goes to the movies.
Last Friday, we all ventured into Burbank for the opening night of Will Eubanks's Underwater, starring Kristen Stewart.
I feel, and I was sensing, I believe that is the first time we've all gone to the movies together in a mainstream opening movie. Like, we've been to
screenings. You mean the ones where we haven't been invited separately and just show up?
Yeah, or Beyond Fest or things like that. But I feel like that's the first time I think we ever met to all go to a movie.
Hey, guys. Yeah, Unity in 2020.
You know what? Unity, guys.
I like
Unity.
It.
No, it was a lot of fun because I remember we used to go to the movies together all the time. Like, I remember seeing so much stuff with you, press screening back when, like, we were doing Killer POV and things like that. And it's been a while, so it was nice to.
I was peer pressured. I had no intention of going to this movie, and then you guys are like, we're all going.
We're doing it.
And were we right?
You were right. It was fun.
We were right.
Had a good time.
No, that was a blast. Like, I'm really considering going back and seeing it again.
I love this film.
It needs it, by the way.
Yeah,
I know. I was devastated to see how it's been doing. Well, that was
the bummer. Yeah, that was the bummer. It was like coming out the other side of the weekend, and we're all like gushing about the film and talking about what a great time it was, and then it's getting like a awful cinema score. The critics hate it. It bombed at the box office.
We had a pretty good crowd for opening night.
We did.
Yeah.
So that's mm-hmm.
I thought
that was an indication. Like, well, I think all
the horror fans came out. You know, there was, and also, I mean, this is the beauty of the evening. One of the highlights, I think, is that there was an entire row in front of us that was all filled up in this. Girl walks up to this guy that's just sitting there, and she goes, "Hi, is this for the horror club meetup?" And he's like, "Yeah." And she's like, "Oh, hi, my name is," you know, she introduces herself, and then someone else further down. I just heard this kind of ripple effect of everybody in this horror club meetup introducing themselves and talking about movies.
It's their first movie together.
I was like, "This is fantastic." I love that existed.
Yeah.
So shout out to you.
Like, rows behind us, we had another row of friends that we knew from trivia.
And we had a Shockwaves listener.
Yeah, and a Shockwaves listener back there. Yeah, it was.
Listen, if you're out there and you're sitting behind us, come say hi and tap on Elric's shoulder.
Tap on my shoulder.
Yeah, go to Elric.
Touch his face.
No, like, you know what I liked about it was, it helped that we all went in with lower expectations. Given that, except for Becca, who just would have accepted anything.
I knew it was going to be gold. It was gold from the start. But anything above, like, Crocaconda Ghost Shark, and I would have been like, I'm in.
But it's like, it's rare that you get a movie like that, that in the first 2 minutes, it is just off to the races. Like, literally, you don't know much about anyone, and there's an explosion, and then you're just in this movie. And I love that. You're just thrown in to the, so it's basically a disaster movie as well, which I love.
All the way, how many miles under?
They're
on a drilling expedition?
Miles.
Yeah. And they're on a drilling expedition, and they, like, something happens in the facility.
An earthquake.
An earthquake disrupts their facility, which starts crushing. The pressure of the water starts crushing their facility floor by floor. So there's this immediate ticking clock as Kristen Stewart and the survivors.
It literally happens in, like, the first 2 minutes.
Yeah. And I appreciate that because I thought we were going to have to, like, get to know all these characters and stuff. Yeah. And it's like within 2 minutes, you're off and running. And I think I was telling Elric after, it's like, because people are like, some of the critiques are, there's no plot, or you can't really get to know the characters.
Bullshit.
No, it's like Kristen Stewart, all right, TJ Miller, Vincent Cassell is the captain.
Yep.
Yeah. It's like, you see him and you're like, okay, I get it. I know who this guy is.
And it's
the way they cast it, I think you know who everyone is as soon as you meet them.
And you don't, I mean, like, I'm sure that they could have spent a long time exploring some of the characters, but honestly, in this, I didn't need them. The building's exploded. No. I don't need to know your backstory right now. Just run. And it still does have a plot because at exactly because like I glanced at my phone right at that moment because my text went off at exactly the 35 minute mark. We get the first inkling that it might not be an earthquake. Like it was perfectly structured out, and so yeah, I had a blast. I cheered multiple times.
Yeah, that was what made it also fun. Just going with somebody who is such a big aquatic horror fan, it was fun that it was actually gleefully delivering when you wanted it to deliver, like multiple times. Yeah. That's the surprising thing, and a lot of different types of creatures, which I really appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but also the casting is really good. It's like obviously this set on the shelf for a little while, I believe.
Yeah.
Before
yeah.
that. Wow. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about the TJ Miller internet world. So like I really don't. So I thought he was hilarious. I would have walked out going, that guy was the MVP of that movie. And then when I go
internet
on Twitter, it just
world.
Says that guy.
Oh, you mean well, Silicon Valley?
Yeah, he's an actor online. No, but he's an actor online who's canceled. Like he's the controversial figure because I don't know what that is.
I have no idea.
I've never
either.
Read up about him. I didn't make an influence on me, which probably helped. No, I read a lot of people say they wouldn't see the movie because he was in it. And I was like, oh, well, that's a bummer. But
I have no idea.
I'm ignorant. But I do love, I thought Vincent Cassell was also really solid as this kind of captain figure. And Kristen Stewart does a great job. And, you know, we're in a year where you're high life. You got Pattinson in space, Kristen Stewart in the sea. And it would be an interesting double feature.
Yeah. I mean, like, I just loved the escalation that it was occurring, and I just love the roller coaster ride that everybody went on. You know, it was constantly ramping up. It was throwing new surprises at you. I like the production design. It was cool to look at. You know, they wear these kind of spacesuits that look a little alien-esque, you know. But, you know, the sea creatures are really cool. I mean, like everything that you've read about it, where it's like Descent underwater, what it isn't, I don't feel in my way is that it's not alien underwater. I mean, like it certainly tips a hat, but I think
that's the abyss.
I feel like alien underwater is just like an old critical way of thinking. It's just like your head out of your ass.
I think Elric said to me, what would you say? You're like, it looks like the abyss, but it feels like Leviathan.
Yeah, exactly.
It has the polish of the abyss. Yeah. You know? And then Michael Winston got mad because Leviathan also looks beautiful. And I'm like, come on.
Of course. Leviathan's beautiful.
It's darker. I feel like that one's shot darker. You know.
Leviathan, it looks better than Deep Star. I'll give you that.
We'll get to that in a second.
Well, I also love that. It feels like they use that budget though. Like everything looks pretty solid. Like everything between the creatures and a lot of the production design and everything. Like there's some really stylistic choices, like stuff happening in slow motion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not by the numbers. It feels impressive. Like he had a vision for this film, which I really thought was cool.
Yeah.
You know? made it feel more for it. Yeah. You know? And there is something about those movies that you do actually get character development. It's just not at the start. It's through watching behavior.
Yeah, and I don't know if this movie necessarily succeeded in delivering all the character arcs and all the character stuff you wanted, but you know what? It's okay to have movies that are just endurance runs.
Yeah.
It's okay to just like hit the ground running and push you through the paces and just become – you know, sometimes it can be sometimes exhausting experience. I mean, like when they have to make a trek from one part of the ocean to the seabed to the other to make it to another facility. And that walk along the path, you know, there's a couple of really cool, intense moments that occur throughout that. And I was just like, by the end, I was like, oh my God, give me a break. Just slow down for a second. And it does, but then it just ramps back up again. Yeah. And I just enjoyed that. I loved those ups and downs.
Yeah, this is one that I do recommend seeing in the theater just because the scope of the monsters, and they look beautiful. I mean, this isn't like a Deep Rising thing where I'm like, you know what? I love your tentacles, but you don't look so great.
The other comparison was last year was Life. And that's a really well-made movie, but the aliens in that never did much for me. Like, I was like, it's interesting.
Kind
it's
of like flubber.
Yeah, whereas this felt like it delivered on that aspect. Which
but again, you know what? I'm so glad that movies like this still exist. I mean, there's the kind of – there's the highbrow monster movies like Quiet Place where you're going to get – you're going to get a spoonful of family drama and emotion along with the cool monster stuff. But every once in a while is just like, no, the monster's front and center.
Yeah.
It's called Life. It's called, you know, it's called Deep Rising. It's called Underwater. And it's okay that those come along every once in a while.
And you need real budgets for sci-fi. I mean, that's the thing. That's the difference with horror and sci-fi, I think, to really – I mean, for this kind of sci-fi. Yeah. And they deliver it. The suits, the costumes, everything, you know.
Everything that's good.
So I went online to diss this. So I went online to talk about Deep Star 6 because I basically said, because it really is similar plot-wise. Like, there's so many similarities.
Mining in Deep Star 6?
Yeah, they're under there to mine. They're super low, and it's a breakdown from the start. But here's the sad part. So I posted make fun of the poster, being like, this is the movie that delivers this poster. Because this is one of those films that I rented a bunch of times, and every time was disappointed, and every time fell for it. And the best part of the story is I post to diss it. And after the post, I went, fuck it, I'm going to watch it again.
And I watched Deep Star 6 again.
And I was thinking to myself, what am I doing? I just kind of glad I did.
Poster gets you every time.
But the main takeaway was, yes, Miguel Ferrer has one of the great, most spectacular death scenes in this as he's trying to come back up to the surface without a suit, and he just fucking explodes.
Is that the guy? Wait, no, it's Twin Peaks. It's not. Okay, yeah. I confuse him with the guy with the rat and six-pack because they're all the same character. Right.
Now, the other guy is the guy from My Two Dads. Remember the TV show My Two Dads? He's the lead, which is the problem.
Which he takes the shower with the naked girl in the opening scene because Deep Star 6 had to open with full nudity.
Well, you know who directed it? It's Sean S. Cunningham. So it did have to open with nudity. Now, the problem with this, and I won't go deep into Deep Star because I know it will have its fans. Honestly, the last 20 minutes is pretty damn fun. But man, the first 80 minutes is it's the opposite of Underwater. First 80 minutes is exposition to get to know characters who really care, doing nothing as they wait to fix their freaking vehicle. But it comes with this kind of crustacean sea creature monster thing, which is pretty rad.
Diplodon.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, I don't even know how I know that name, but he's supposed to look like a sea scorpion.
Yeah, that's basically what it was. But again, the difference being you're looking at a practically made thing that at certain points you're like, okay, that's fun, but you don't believe it the way
they
you believe.
They also never explain origin. Well, I mean, they don't explain origin in Underwater either. They're just hanging out. Yeah,
But
I'm a Diplodon. What do you want from me?
It's a fun double. I mean, I Leviathan's still one of my favorites of these kind of movies. But
and Leviathan, they weren't mining. They were were a research facility. I remember. I'm always intrigued by what puts them.
Yeah, no, it's true. That's
it's
a
usually
good point,
mining. Like Abyss, I think they were mining.
I think so. Yeah. Well, and also, just sort of friendly reminder to many people out there: if you have HBO, The Abyss is actually streaming in HD.
Mm-hmm. Along with True Lies. When was the last time I saw The Abyss? Because I haven't seen it.
Well, I haven't seen it in a very long time. I rewatched The True Lies, and it looked fantastic.
Yeah, that's on there.
Yeah,
I hear The Abyss is not the director's cut. I don't know. I don't know the difference between all these things, but it is on there.
Yeah. So interesting. Yeah. But now remind me, Deep Star 6 is the one where they shot on sound stages, not actual underwater photography.
They definitely looked like
that. But they pumped in like elements to float in the air. So it looked like, So
and at a certain point, they open the doors and they're flooded. So they're just flooding sound stages. That's what it felt like.
Interesting.
But then, there's some cool underwater, but it's very, Star Wars, like where they're being taken under by the sea creature. But I mean, you could watch worse things, but it was interesting to see. I thought there was a lot of similarities between these two, actually.
Yeah.
But the better films in theaters still. and I'll tell you, I actually ended up watching a third. It ended up being three Aqua films, but I'll come back around in a row, weirdly enough.
All right.
Well, I'm going to jump in with The Outsider. Did anybody else watch it?
Oh my God.
It is so good.
So basically, Shockwave's approved already.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Two episodes in.
Two episodes.
So who read the book? You read the book?
No. I did.
I don't want to know anything.
I read the book, too. Yeah.
And it's one of his best of the last decade or whatever.
It's pretty terrific. The book, I mean, it was one of those summer reads last year that I sat down. And it just starts, man. Automatically begins. And like he starts bouncing around between these interviews along with the arrest of the coach. And I was just like hooked. Like I legit could not put that book down all summer long. Like I got through it pretty quick. But Becca.
Two episodes.
So good.
So yeah, the setup is there's this murder. It's this very small town. And there is this absolutely brutal, brutal murder of an 11-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm. And, Dr. Sleep style kind of thing.
It's really real, real heinous. And it completely rips the town apart. And within about 10 minutes, this isn't a spoiler, it's totally the setup, you find out that that a lot of people saw the coach do it. This like little league coach who has this like glowing reputation in the town, played by Jason Bateman.
They do it. They see it. They witness him in every possible spot around the murder, right?
Yeah.
Like walking away from it,
he's
on the way
bloody,
to it.
Yeah. It's like driving literally everything that could possibly indicate that he was somehow connected with it. They saw him later that night. His clothes were covered in blood and he was acting
he's
weird.
On video evidence.
Video.
His prints.
There's blood on his truck. And so it's like everything that could possibly connect him to this murder, they have. He talked to a little girl at the scene and all this stuff. But then he was also like 60 miles away at a convention at the exact same time.
Where they also have video footage of him being at
yes.
the convention.
Yeah.
The creepiest thing is the footage they have of the murder guy. He'll just stare at
He stares at the camera.
He wants to be seen.
So, yeah.
And that's what's eerie about it.
This is the setup. You get all of this within about the first 20 minutes of the first episode is the idea that this murder has happened, this absolutely heinous murder. This guy has been accused. They have all this evidence against him. But at the same time, they also have evidence that he is like 60 miles away in this other place. And then this kind of eerie stuff starts creeping in. And I'll stop with
that's
the plot summary there.
And that's Jason Bateman playing that character.
And he directed
He directed both episodes and he plays the coach character
that
gets
arrested.
I think
he directs all the series.
Oh, really?
I think I read that he does all 10.
That's insane.
But the
sheriff is Ben Mendelsohn.
One of my favorite actors of this generation.
And this is like the role we've been waiting for him to do.
Oh, mm-hmm. my God, yeah.
And a big part of the drama is, you know, because of the heinousness of the crime, it's like emotions are very high. And he makes the decision to make it a very public thing.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
He's like, this is so horrible. I want everyone to know he did it.
Right.
Because obviously they have all this evidence and it's like, it's a slam dunk. It's obviously him. Until all that other stuff comes up and you're like, how is it possible for him to be responsible if he was at this other place?
I was going to say one of the great moments is that when the Bateman character's lawyer comes in, he's like, you had to arrest him in front of everybody.
Yeah.
And he's like, and you had to do it with two cops. You couldn't arrest him yourself. And he's like, and Mendelsohn's character is like, if I did it myself, I don't know what I would have done to him. I probably would have torn him to pieces.
And because he coached his son.
His late son. Yeah.
And that was one of like the things that I found to be really most captivating. I mean, the first episode's creepy as hell, and then it keeps escalating from there. But the fact that in addition to all this creepy stuff, we're seeing how this just ripples through this small town because everyone knows each other and everyone at first is like, the coach? It can't be the coach. Wait, there's all this stuff. It's the coach.
Yeah.
And even when they arrest him, one of the very first things that one of the cops says to him is, did you touch my son? Like, it just, everyone knows each other and it immediately becomes this, like, ripping the world apart.
Yeah.
Which seems to be, and you can really mention this part because you guys know where the story goes, but, like, it feels like maybe that's kind of be the point of whatever's going on. It's kind of like American Outlet, where somebody can do something that will then create negative ripples through something. And that's maybe what they're feeding off order. I don't know where it goes, but I like that feeling because I can't tell where it's going to go.
Yeah.
And I'm almost – what I like is it places you as almost perplexed as the Ben Mendelsohn character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It shows you a little bit more because you see a guy in the crowd. And so you get a little hints of things. But it doesn't go beyond that yet in two episodes.
And
I was really into it.
Yeah, and I really like the tone of it as well. I mean, like in terms of pure adaptation, this is about as faithful as you can get. Mm.
Nice.
Yeah.
And it was funny because Ciara didn't read the book, but – she was instantly glued to the show, and I took a minute to just to kind of walk away. I had to go to use the restroom, and she was like, "You're missing like part." And I was like, "No, I know what happens because this thing is so faithful. I know the beats that are coming, but I enjoy watching that, you know, because Bateman does it with such assured direction, and it's kind of got this kind of true detective tone to it too.
Exactly.
Procedural,
procedural. And then it's got a great cast of like character actors like Mara Winningham, Hetian Park from Hannibal.
Yeah.
You know, it's got Patty Considine.
The guy who plays his lawyer, Bateman's lawyer, he was in that other really great HBO show the other year where John Turturro was the lawyer.
Bill Camp you're talking about.
Bill Camp.
And he is so good in roles like that, that actor.
And I'd say, I don't know about you, Ron, but since you read it also, I'd say like 99%. Because you know you imagine different people.
Yeah.
I think they cast it pretty spot on.
So good.
I expected Howie to be just a little older based on what I read in the book.
The hair right.
Yeah, but within 5 minutes, I'm like, oh no, this guy's Howie.
As I read,
so it's really cool. Yeah,
I can't wait. And there's a character who's going to be coming into play, and I cannot wait to see how she's realized. She's like one of my favorite.
I did see a trailer, but I turned it off. So.
Yeah, and the trailer is not at all what I imagined, but I think that's cool. Because if you read a book, you want to have some surprises. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, she comes from the world of Mr. Mercedes, the Mr. Mercedes arcs.
Ooh.
Yeah.
All Okay.
It really so looks great. Good.
Yeah, yeah. I watched the first episode, and then after this, I was like, okay, I'm rejoining HBO Go, which I do every couple of months. I'm always like, no, I'm done. And then I want to watch more this week, tomorrow, tonight, or no, I'm done. And then Silicon Valley comes back or something like that. So,
Curb Your Enthusiasm's back this week.
Is it?
Back. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is the most Rob show ever. I can picture. Yeah, that's very Rob show.
The Outsider on HBO. So I got one that's, I think the bar was so low that I had zero. I mean, no, legitimately, sometimes you hear about things and you're like, oh, all right, whatever.
That's how you go into a movie.
I mean, we said it about Underwater. Like, yeah. I had a pretty low bar on that, and it turned out to be a lot of fun. Yeah. But I finally caught up with Zombieland Double Tap. And this movie is actually
okay,
this is
enough.
Not where I thought you were going.
This is way more fun than it's pretty good. Ryan, why are you making that face at me?
I did not know this movie was out. I thought it was coming out like next summer.
It came out already around October, I think, for Halloween season, and then it's on it's on Blu-ray and digital now.
And this is the Jim
Jarmusch
one.
So I caught up to it. No, not the Jim Jarmusch one.
How many of these do we have?
No, not at all. No, I mean, here's the thing. Again, I think you're walking into it, part of the expectation is kind of like, oh, it's been 10 years. Do we really need another one or whatever? And technically, the answer is no. But it's the same – I don't want to say issue. But yeah, it is. It's the same issue I kind of had with something like Little Monsters, where it's a great movie. I just don't think now is the right time. Point being, in 5 years from now, if you watch Zombieland and Zombieland Double Tap, you'll be like, oh, these are great. Yeah. They're both – they tried to do that Amazon pilot where they recast it, and it just did not have the spark at all. Mm-hmm. But within 2 minutes, when you see all four of these actors again, it's there. They're like, it's really funny. There's a lot of fun to it. It's just, it's like quirky stuff. Like 10 years later, I think they're living in the White House for a little while and kind of like, that's getting accustomed. And they've basically fallen into a family unit. So Woody Harrelson, I mean, him alone. Woody Harrelson is definitely the father figure of the little girl now, who is now not a little girl. And so she's being rebellious because this is the only people she's ever known in her life. So it's kind of fun in that regard. And then when they venture out into the world again and run into some other characters, some of the zombies are evolving. So there's that kind of like element to it too. But I mean, look, it's basically, if you liked the first movie, I think you'll actually thoroughly enjoy this. They had Rosario Dawson in it, and she's got a great bit with Woody Harrelson. Yeah. And Bill Murray may come back in some fashion if you wait through the credits. Oh, okay. And it's actually really funny, I thought. So, no, I mean, there's not much to say other than if you like the first one, you'll probably dig this one. It was, I didn't expect much, and I just had fun with it. And I laughed out loud a lot.
So business wise, this one tanked then, if we didn't know it was even really out, right?
I don't know.
Did this do anything?
I think it did well.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. All right.
Yeah, there's some fun stuff. I mean, there's jokes that I like that are like, obviously, since it's been an apocalypse for 10 years, like they pick up a girl who is supposed to be very, very dim. And she's like, you know what I would come up with is like, you should, if only you could take rides with strangers, like you just plug it into your phone or something. And then they're like, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. That would never happen. She's like, no, I think if society didn't break down and we could get in a car with strangers and carpool and all that and pay for it, it would be great. So it's like humor like that, that I'm like, all right, this is
same
fun.
Director?
As the yeah. Okay. Yeah. Whole same, okay, cool. Whole team. Exactly. Oh, yeah. Same cast, same director,
man,
same writers.
Back. That's big.
Mm. Yeah. No, it's fun. Yeah. I like it. Zombieland Double Tap.
All right.
Let me see. There's a bunch of things I wanted to talk about, but I want to talk about experience playing a video game. And I've realized that video game horror is probably the only horror today that can actually get to me and chill me to the bone and scare the living shit out of
me. As in video games that are scary or horror movies about video games?
No, video games that are scary.
Okay, cut.
Yeah. My kid got me Resident Evil 2, the remake. And my God, they did an amazing job with, delivering new graphics. It's a whole new gameplay. It feels like I'm playing this for the first time all over again. But oh my God, it's scary as shit, Elric.
Even watching people play those games can be pretty scary if it's in the dark.
Yeah,
the photorealism of it all now.
I remember playing like Silent Hill.
It's very hard for me. It's very my heart rate goes up. It's insane. But anyways, that was a great experience. But I'm here to talk about a film called Edge of the Axe.
Ooh. We're doing it. Is this it? We're throwing down.
I want to talk about Edge of the Axe, guys, because I watched it over the weekend. Rob, Yes. Hand me that Blu-ray.
Yes, this glorious Blu-ray.
This package is beautiful. You've got a very dynamic image. You're obviously in the POV of a woman with a wedding ring on, and you're looking at the door, and coming through the door is a white-masked killer with a black jacket and a giant axe, and it's dynamic and it's beautiful, and even edge of the axe is in silver with blood dripping down it. This is a movie for me, and then I watch it. And it still is.
That's what I thought, man.
Car wash.
No, car wash.
Opening.
That's
all I really remember.
It opens in a car wash, and it takes place in court, like California, somewhere ambiguous. And it opens with a car wash kill, where a woman is driving in her car, and she's going through the car wash, and there's the brushes hitting the car, and there's the soapy suds and all that shit. And suddenly, this fucking killer steps in front of her car with an axe, and starts whacking at the windshield and the woman within as if this axe weighs nothing.
Yes.
I mean, this has to be a super extreme, super like super strong killer. And it's not. It's just like terribly – the axe probably doesn't weigh anything. But
it's 88, Ryan. This is when our killers were superhuman.
I know, man. I know. but then it's followed by a credit sequence – with a dude on a motorcycle, and I'm watching it, and the credits are done in kind of 80s computer font. See them being typed on screen. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? What does a computer have to do with anything in this fucking slasher movie? This is not what I was getting sold on the cover. I thought like this is the kind of credits you get with Evil Speak or something like that. What you come to realize is that computers play a giant part in Edge of the Axe.
Could be the first internet movie.
Yeah, ooh. You would say, yeah, this is definitely the first internet
movie.
Does
this predate the Clint Howard one?
Evil Speak.
Evil Speak, thank you.
It's after Evil Speak.
Okay.
Yeah. It's after Evil Speak. But what you have is basically you've got a killer running around this kind of like small town in California. It looks like Big Bear. And you're focusing on a computer nerd, his best friend who's married to an older woman. He hates her and he hates being married to her. But he's married to her for her money. And there's kind of weird attempts at 80s screwball sex comedy humor. And our computer nerd falls for this girl. And he hooks her up with an old computer. And he hooks her up with the internet. And they talk to each other.
It's not called the internet, though.
No, it's not called the internet.
We could talk to each other computer to computer.
We could talk to each other computer to computer. And we get all these great scenes where she hops online and she just types in, "Are you there?" And then you hear the voiceover of the computer speak, go, "Are you there?" and then she stays there and looks at the screen. And then he goes, "Yes, hi, how are you?" Which is followed by, "Yes, hi, how are you?" And it's like such a fucking weird like way to shoot this whole drama. So while you've got this love affair thing going on, you've got the sheriff who is investigating all of these murders. But you know what, Rob? Mm-hmm. The sheriff reminds me of the camp director from Sleepaway Camp, the one who's like, "Oh, this murder. Oh, what are you talking about? That's not a murder. It's an accident. That's just an accident." Every kill, this sheriff comes along. He's just like, she just committed suicide. That's all it is. Just a suicide.
With an axe.
And then what was the train murder where he's like, "Well, I reckon that, she just stumbled her way onto the tracks because she was drunk. She fell into the train."
Yeah, that's what happened. And by the way, just in case you're curious, like the opening scene, like the axe murder, especially in the opening, is they're like all ferocious.
Mm. Yeah.
And so anytime you're like, "Oh, what's going on with this movie? Why am I dealing with this internet love relationship, whatever?" Don't worry. A really vicious axe attack will come out of nowhere where you're like, "Ooh, that's pretty nasty." Yeah. All right, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And the axe murderers are, like you said, they're very vicious. But the guy like swings this axe like it's a fucking wiffle ball bat, and, you know, with such ease. And, the movie just kind of gave me Pieces vibes.
Yeah, totally.
And when you get Pieces vibes, it's A-okay. But it's got Jack Taylor in it from Pieces.
Well, it's nominally on the back. It actually writes this nominally set in Northern California, but shot in Madrid. but you know, it's weird. Yeah. And I did not know this when I saw this years ago with Rob, but not a good copy, like a crappy copy. Yeah. I am a little bit shook, as the kids say, because this is directed by a guy called Jose Ramon Larraz, who is, this would be the equivalent if like Carpenter made Pieces. This is not in line with his filmography.
Yeah. What's some of his other stuff?
Vampires, but Symptoms.
Oh,
somebody sent
Symptoms.
Symptoms is like a minimalist, let's scare Jessica to death type, even more restrained. Yeah. So like, it makes
Harold's
no sense.
Been going through his whole filmography, and
I got the
box. Box set of his earlier films.
Dick bought me Symptoms, and I watched it, and I was like,
that's
this is an art house thing.
Responsible for this
that's
masterpiece.
Really interesting. I have Symptoms sitting on my shelf. I would
it's
never
good. It's like a really cool minimalist, but it doesn't make any sense in connection with this movie.
I haven't seen Symptoms, but based on vampires.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
he's like an art house kind of
slumming over here.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe that was his breakover to America. Yeah.
Well, I love the one sequence where the killer's chasing the girl by the train tracks. Yeah. And then he's unmasked, so she's like, "Oh, it's you," and then out of nowhere he just like whips out the white mask, and you're like, "Oh," and you kind of see who it is, but you're like, "That person's not in this movie at
totally
all."
Totally betrays who the actual killer is.
That's weird. Okay. But on this Blu-ray, you could see clearly that it's somebody that's not in the
and
movie.
Look, without giving anything away, what I especially loved is how it pushed the slasher genre into an area that I don't think had been covered before. In terms of masked killer reveals, it's interesting. We'll have an offline conversation about it. But there was one particular actress who had written a editorial in a recent Fangoria about this particular subject matter, and I want to write to her and go, "You have to see this movie now because it's something I had no idea about." But yeah, this is a wild, wild movie, and it made my Saturday afternoon so much better. Edge of the axe. But there's a great booklet in there that kind of dives into Spanish film productions that took place in America.
Yeah, which I love that.
Absolutely.
Because they go out of their way to tell you it's America, and I love that.
Yeah. But Edge of the Axe, Arrow Video.
Great release.
Get it. Oh, and let me just add, too, I saw Cruising for the first time.
Yeah.
And then we had a little Twitter exchange with our where to put the handkerchief when you came here today. It was like yellow front pocket.
What color's your handkerchief, Ray?
It's, I don't know.
You strike me as a brown handkerchief back left pocket kind of guy.
I mean, the movie is fascinating. I mean, like Bill Neal showed it to me, and he's been trying to get me to see it for a very, very long time, and it's just kind of one of those holes in the William Friedkin career path that I had never seen. And it is a fascinating movie. I have no idea how this movie got made
and it's
very good. It's excellent. I mean, like, Pacino's great in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that it's really ambiguous who the actual killer is. There was a moment where I was, you're watching the killer take out this guy, but he's speaking in this very like seductive voice. And I was like, that guy,
you're here.
So creepy. Here.
Yeah. I think it's actually one of the few like horror films that I watched in the theater recently again, that those parts actually creep me out because you don't know where it's coming from. And I think because of the lifestyle of the guys in the movie, they're so vulnerable that you feel it. It's like quite upsetting.
Yeah. And it's just a great commentary on, identity in that period and in that scene. And
it's before AIDS, which is hard to believe because it does feel like it's commenting on something that would be spreading insidiously in a group, but also has an amazing ending, and some of the stuff with Pacino at the end is like some of the implications of this movie are pretty fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Like it hits you like as a cop film and a horror film. I think it's really a great movie. I mean, it has camp silly parts. But,
It does have some silly parts to it, but it's very well done. And the re-release, which is – who did that? Scream Factory?
Arrow.
Thank you. Arrow one, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
But there is a great – so when – because we saw this double with Sorcerer a few years ago at the Arrow with the legendary Q&A with Friedkin going back and forth to Mike Williamson. So the missing 18 minutes or whatever the hell it is of kind of the porn stuff, it was just such a great story. He said back then the sense would come to your house to watch the movie with you.
So he
tells this amazing story how the censor comes to his house and he goes, "So let me just be honest with you guys. I literally shot like 20 minutes of porn just because I knew the censor would come. And I thought if he just watches this porn stuff, the real extreme shit, he will censor that and leave the rest of the movie alone." And he goes, "The guy shows up and he's wearing a coat and a sweater and we all start watching the movie and then the scarf comes off. And then the sweater. And the guy is sweating like a pig. And freaking sitting behind him watching him slowly derobe. And the guy's like, 'You can't show this movie.' And just freaking losing it. And the way he described it was so funny to think of that relationship. And of course, they took out the 20 minutes that was porn. He goes, literally nothing that he wanted to take was stuff I cared about. It was like just shot to fucking push the buttons. I'm smart. Like, that's so smart.
Wow.
Freaking so cool. I love freaking. So much fun. I'm glad you guys see that. I like that film.
Yeah.
I finished my aquatic trilogy that ended up being four in a row because I saw the cartoon Ponyo the next day, not even thinking, oh, wow, no. But this is Sweetheart, which is one that you had talked about.
I had talked about this earlier, and I liked this film, except...
Yeah, well, I get it. So it's what struck me about this one was it feels very similar to Headhunter mm-hmm. in terms of structure, mm-hmm. in terms of the kind of movie it is. One person alone, well, mostly one person alone, trapped on an island. She washes up with another person who then dies. You have no context, kind of like Underwater. You have no context of where they came from initially.
Yeah.
It takes a while before they reveal. What is the actress's name?
She's great in it.
Yeah, she has a really great presence in this. Kiersey Clemons.
Yeah, I described it as Castaway. If when he washed up, he was like, "Holy shit, there's a fucking monster on the island."
But let's just say, like, if I was doing top 10 moments of last year's cinema again right now, and if we were doing that episode, the monster reveal in this movie is gonna be an all timer for people. It's beautiful,
was a great reveal,
gorgeous. Like, I mean, but it's just like cinematically. I won't even go. I don't want to say what it is, but it's a beautiful reveal. That said, my issue with so it's basically about this girl. She's trying to survive on this island. On the first night there, she realizes an animal is dragged out. There's a dead corpse on the beach, and it is savagely, you know, more or less eaten and then taken back into the sea. She then starts to realize every night something is coming from this kind of portal hole in the sea, which is super cool. I thought that element and taking food back, and then of course she becomes kind of game. The only problem is it's not so much like it'd be easy to go, it's a creature design problem. It's not that. It's just that I don't really know anything about what the creature part of this movie is as I'm watching it. So it doesn't help. That was the one part, but I still really like this movie.
Yeah,
Ulrich
texts me and he's like, "Can you tell me about this creature? Why does it move like this?" Like, I had some type of biological insight.
You're my aquatic go-to.
No, and that was what I immediately kind of bucked with, is the creature reveal when you first realize that there's something on the island.
Great art.
It was beautiful. It was beautifully done. But then as soon as you see the creature, it's bipedal. And there's just things of it that really kind of pushed me out, that made me go, oh, it's a dude in a suit.
Or a little too human, little too much. Unless there's going to be a reason. Like, I could go with, in the way that Descent, I could go with that thing like, oh, a miners were stuck here and they turned into something. If this had had some, even a little, I probably would have bought in a little more. But it still was fun. And it's like, I still went with it. But I like the structure. I liked how it's like, one of these 83-minute horror films that you can't really go wrong.
Yeah.
But that and Headhunters have a lot in common if you're into it. But and then other characters do kind of come into it. But she's really good. I thought it was cool.
Yeah,
movie.
I had a blast with this. Yeah. So much so that I was willing to, you know, stay with it and go like, okay, the creature's not exactly what I would have, you know, wanted. But that said, it's still a lot of fun and I'm fucking in. So let's do this.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So I'm glad I saw that one though.
That's Sweetheart. And that's on Netflix now. That's how you watch it?
Yes. Yeah. And J.D. Dillard, who did the, was it Slight? Before Slight, this, which was also kind of like another one of those like smaller films that punched above its weight in a lot of ways, which is cool. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that this is going to lead to a bigger kind of production because he's showing what he can do with smaller scopes. So cool.
So I started school this week back to teaching at USC. Back to the grind.
Back to school.
And one of the things that I absolutely love about teaching at USC is the majority of the professors that I end up teaching with, I'm like, holy shit, you have 3 Academy Awards and we're just like teaching together. And it's really cool. So I was introing one of my classes and the person who was co-teaching it with me was an editor who I had not met before. And so he shows up on the first day and we're doing our intros. And he's like, yeah, I worked on Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom, Cool Runnings. And I did a whole bunch of horror films. And I'm immediately like, hold on. Back up, what? And then he was like, so I did everything with Frank Mancuso. So like Friday 4, Friday 5, April Fool's Day. And then immediately I'm like, I have questions, sir. So as soon as we get to break, I'm asking him all these questions about the footage and what they had and what they didn't have and how things turned out. And I was so excited to talk with him about everything that I ended up going back and rewatching 1986's April Fool's Day.
Yeah. I've been meaning to rewatch that one.
Scream Factory.
Okay.
I believe, yeah.
I'm a big fan.
I have not seen it, I dare say, since high school.
Really?
Like, I had vague, and I've never seen the remake. I know they did a remake in like 2008.
The Butcher Brothers.
Yeah, with like Taylor Scott Compton. And I had never seen that one. And I remembered, as soon as I started talking with him about it, I was like, God, I used to really like that movie. And then I realized I hadn't revisited it in like decades.
Is Ginny in that? From Friday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's right. That was my memory.
Amy Steele.
Yeah, and Amy Steele. And it's still so fun. Yeah. Like, and I'm not usually like, I I like slashers, but it's not usually my go-to. I would rather have something possessed or monster crawling out of the ocean. But rewatching it, it was just such a blast. The setup is group of college students get an invite to kind of go to a friend of a cousin's house for the weekend, this massive cabin. So the person or mansion, and there's a whole bunch of them, so much so that I kind of lost track, but you get the idea that they have to have a whole bunch of people to knock off throughout the course of the movie. So like 10 of them roll in to this lake riverfront mansion for this weekend getaway. And as soon as they get there, there's an accident with somebody on the dock where he gets kind of crushed against a boat. So you get this kind of brutal accident from the get-go. And then they get to the mansion and it's supposed to be this kind of April Fool's Day celebration. So there's a lot of tricks throughout it, like dribble glasses and little like cutesy tricks. And then quickly they realize that there's something off about the host, this girl that they've never met before, that there's something weird going on, and that they all start disappearing. And so then it takes kind of more a traditional slasher route, but a certain number of the people realize that there's something weird going on with the guy from the dock, and then they start uncovering weird secrets about their hostess. And so,
Agatha Christie.
And that's what I remembered loving is that the kills were cool. It had really good kills. The setup was not just, I've been wronged as a child and now I'm going to pick you people off. Right. It was very much like a murder mystery of trying to uncover why everyone was dying, who this person is, and what all's going on in this weird, creepy mansion. And yeah, it was just a blast. I had a great time.
Yeah, it's one of those movies I remember seeing it for the first time. I mean, it's very hard to talk about in depth without going into spoilers.
Yeah.
So maybe like
– until Scream Factory.
Just like
maybe
jump ahead like 30 seconds. But I know there were a lot of people that the movie is divisive because of that finale.
Mm-hmm. You know, it does. It completely reinvents itself at the end. The
movie's called April Fool's Day.
Yeah.
And it delivers on that promise.
But have you heard about the novelization to April Fool's Day?
No.
Maybe when we have Steve Scarlatta or Jim Koons back on. So the novelization, it's the movie, but then another 30 minutes after the movie where it really does happen.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So the novelization just goes there. And you're like, wait, what?
I need to find this.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know how hard it is to come by, but we should definitely talk to them about
somebody,
that.
Somebody, I think it was Koons or Scarlatta, they went to like one of the book fairs and I picked it up there. And it was a book fair that I wanted to go to.
Is it the Glendale one? That was really good.
We gotcha. Cool. April Fool's Day. Yeah, I got to double check, but I know Scream Factory is about to put that out.
Sweet.
And then lastly for me, last night I went to the LA premiere of Color Out of Space, the new movie from Richard Stanley, which I know
I've seen.
Everybody's seen it, right? Yeah. You guys saw it at Beyond Fest a couple months ago. I did not know really much of anything other than obviously Nicolas Cage, Richard Stanley coming back. And I kind of loved this movie. I thought it was pretty spectacular. I referred to it as a wild, wacky trip through Richard Stanley's magenta-tinted world. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I will say this. I wouldn't say it's necessarily scary, but we're talking about a Lovecraft story that he kind of expanded upon. And the basic premise is like Nicolas Cage has a family and they're raising
alpacas.
Alpacas.
It's my favorite element of this movie.
The alpacas are the best part. But what about the alpacas?
Can we milk that?
Which, by the way, my fiance actually in her review said that Nicolas Cage milking an alpaca on screen might be his greatest contribution to cinema.
That's pretty amazing.
And I agree with her. But basically a meteorite falls on his property and a lot of strange things start happening that affect time, that affect the animals, that affect everything. And so this gets
including
really
– including Nick's intonation.
Yes. So it gets really surreal and crazy and weird. And I love that about it. There's a little element of The Thing in there too. There's some imagery and things, ideas presented that I thought were pretty horrific. And it so much so that this movie actually gave me a nightmare last night. Mm. I haven't had a nightmare in years, and the fate of his wife, I'll put it that way.
There's a scene in an attic. That's all you need to know. That I think is one of the best Lovecraft images I've seen.
Everything that happens in the attic upset me so much because of the sounds and everything that was that it gave me a nightmare last night. but I mean, look, I like Hardware. Dust Devil's cool. I think this is Stanley's best movie by far. At least in terms of
bigger
execution.
Bigger canvas, too.
Bigger canvas, very confidently directed and put together. The visual effects were great, like because you never know when you're dealing with a movie of this scale. Like, oh, I hope you know the CG or whatever looks good, but it's a good mix of CG and practical, and it's done really, really well.
And this had been 20 years since he had made a film,
about 20 years,
or a feature film.
And he was there last night with Nick Cage
with his hat off. Did you steal his hat?
I saw he had bangs now.
I did not.
What the fuck is his hat?
He may have been.
He was being classy.
Under the influence of something. I can guarantee he was under the influence when he went up on stage.
He functions under that. Like, I don't know if he's ever.
I think you're right because he was pretty spot on, even though he looked like he was on another planet. Like in terms of, he was great with the Q&A. Nick Cage looked like, I mean, Ghost Rider.
Yeah.
With that freaking, you know, Marilyn Manson was in the audience. It's pretty crazy. I didn't know this. They met each other 30 years ago because Nick was almost in Dust Devil.
Oh, wow.
He said, oh, yeah, I wanted to work with him since Dust Devil.
That would have been a very different movie.
Didn't work out for whatever reason. And when his name came up again, I was like, oh, yeah, let's do it. And I forgot he told Nick told a great story that because they shot this in Portugal for several weeks. And basically they did have a little bit of rehearsal time. And the first day that they all show up for rehearsal, like Richard Stanley pulls out like two pebbles and like rubs them together and they start bleeding. And he's just like, okay, let's start. And he's like, man, this guy's making like rocks bleed. Like this, I'm in. Like,
I really want to know about the bleeding rocks.
We'll have to get Richard Stanley.
That
back.
Sounds like a Richard Stanley story when he was trying to make this, and his mother was like, she was dying, and she had like she was the Lovecraft fan, and she had like glaucoma or something, and her eyesight was going blind, and he found meteorites,
yes.
and rubbed them together and took the juice and poured it on her eyes.
That's what he said.
And
this
it
is
solved
these are,
her vision.
He said these are meteorites,
yes,
and he rubbed them together, and a red liquid came out of it or whatever. Which is pretty wild. So this is coming out January 24th, later this month. It's actually getting a pretty – I mean it's still small, but it's getting a pretty decent big screen release.
Definitely a big screen movie because of the visuals and the scale of it.
Yeah.
The effects.
I don't think it'd be as good at home.
Yeah.
So if it's playing anywhere near you, I strongly recommend trying to see it on the big screen. I think you'll have a really good time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Nick Cage is really fun. And what he does – you know, but people always go, he goes to Nick Cage. It actually really suits what – is happening to the characters in this?
Yeah.
And I like that.
A lot of times I feel like Nick Cage is in a different movie than most of
the
cast.
Whoever, yeah. I don't know where the rest of them are.
Whatever movie he is in is one movie that is very cool, and then everyone else is in a different movie. This one, it feels like he is he's pulling everything else with him.
Yeah.
Like it definitely is a very cagey movie and it functions well like
cagey
that.
Cagey movie.
Cagey movie.
See what you did there.
Yeah.
So yeah, Color Out of Space. And before we bring our guest on, I just wanted to mention, if you are LA-based, tomorrow, Dark Delicacies in Burbank, we're doing a signing for Fangoria Issue 6. Whole bunch of cool people are coming. Joe Bigos, Josh Ethier, they're on the cover with VFW. I got Adam Egypt Mortimer for Daniel Isn't Real because that's on the cover. April Wolf, who wrote Black Christmas. If you want to meet Brian Collins, he'll be there. He wrote a Black Xmas article in there. And I'll be there. And maybe some of my co-hosts. We'll see.
Yeah.
So come on down.
And, what time is that on Saturday?
Oh, 4 p.m. Saturday, January 18th.
You could go right
Dark
after
Delicacies.
Seeing a Miyazaki film.
Oh, yeah. We're going to go see. We're taking –
That's 2 to 4, and then you
we're
go
And then
go
come straight here, yeah.
Kiki's Delivery Service.
Miyazaki and then Fangoria signing.
Yeah.
Great.
And I just want to give a shout-out to our new incarnation of Slashback Video, Slashback Video the
Beginning. That's right.
If you're in Los Angeles, the opening reception is on February 22nd and will run through June. I can elaborate here more than I have on social media, but there's going to be a kind of a narrative element to it.
Mm.
It's going to be a little through line that,
is this immersive?
Slashback's inherently immersive, but it'll make you feel like you're part of a story.
Nice.
It's called The Beginning. Are we looking at an origin story?
An origin story of Mr. Tapehead himself. Iconic.
What?
Our icon, Mr. Tapehead.
I love it.
Yeah, it's really fun. Ciara and I sat down with our partners, Kiko and Eric, over at the Mystic Museum in Burbank, California. And we kind of put together the bones of what it could be. And then it was really fun. It was actually fun collaborating with my wife over like cracking a story. We hatched a story over some coffee and got giddy about it. And now we just need to execute it in 6 weeks. But yeah, it's going to be really fun. So you'll get all the same fun Slashback thrills, some new surprises, a new facet, a new addition to the actual video store itself. So
cool.
It's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
A baby of Tapehead. Ooh.
Baby. Yes. We're going to do Slashback Babies.
Before we depart, Elric and I are leaving on a jet plane in just a couple of weeks. The two of us are headed to 1 week.
It's next week, yeah.
It's not next weekend. It's the weekend. Wait. Oh, I guess when this airs, it is the weekend.
Yeah, it's 1 week away.
Anyway, it's the 24th through the 26th. For those of you who are thoroughly confused,
the most
now.
Exciting guest. We're going to Panic Fest.
I'm excited.
Yes, but and we have the best guest for you. They don't know it yet, and we don't know it, but it's going to be the best guest. I have no idea.
Well,
I've been looking up every day. Who's there?
Well, on Saturday, I am doing a Nightmare University focused on how to make a micro-budget horror film. So we'll be kind of breaking down like what steps you take to approach a horror film. And when I say like micro-budget, I mean like under $250,000. Like how do you – with A.J. Bowen is joining me. Yeah. And then also I think Bria Grant's going to come by and hang out as well and talk about kind of her experience with Lucky and – And AJ's going to talk about some of his experiences on micro budgets. So we're going to break down the steps and then have a conversation about like, you know, what works and what doesn't work.
And I can't
that's
be there
Saturday.
Sadly, because I'm doing Rodman.
Which I am bummed. I can't see Rodman's movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen Rodman's film, so I'm going to get to see it. And then they wanted me to host his Q&A.
Great.
I'm like, hell yes, Rodman. And so Rodman was excited to hang out because I haven't seen him for a while. But we have not yet booked our – we have a cool topic.
We've got a couple of cool topics.
No, we have a cool topic. We just
with.
Haven't booked a person.
We'll figure it out. So that's going to be Sunday morning. You can come see Elric and I talking about a cool topic.
And I think if you have the pass, it's free.
Yes.
So – come see.
So yeah,
these guys will phone in or something.
And that is Panic Fest in Kansas City. There are some really good films playing there.
A huge lineup of stuff. Some of the big kind of hits from last year. Jeremy Gardner's one that we've been at After Midnight. But there's one called. There's one where the girl's cleansing or something, where she keeps drinking washing detergent.
The Cleanse?
Not The Cleanse. No. That's a different one. Yeah. This is about – and I heard really good things coming out of Beyond Fest last year, played in the kind of the free theater. Yeah. And I can't remember if it's The Cleaning – whatever it is, it's about somebody who becomes almost obsessed with just drinking any – yeah, it sounds really gross, but apparently it's a really effective
–
I'm all about that
There was a couple that I was reading over that I was like, I am kind of into this.
I think Saturday will be movie hopping day.
Yeah. Get there. Excellent. So come see us, Kansas City Panic Fest.
Boom.
Excellent. Any other plugs?
I think that's it.
Any other appearances, guys? Rob, you're going to pop up somewhere where fans
can
see
at Fangor? He's going to be at the
tomorrow.
Weekend.
Dark Galaxies.
No, I know. Come not beyond that.
Beyond. Well, let's take it 1 week at a time, Ryan.
All right. Fair enough. All right. We will be right back after a special word from our sponsors.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all around the world. Diabolik offers one-stop shopping experience for all your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo, Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you are looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is owner-operated, small business choice you have been craving. Shop online today at DiabolikDVD.com.
It's 2020 and Fangoria Magazine is back on shelves and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fangoria editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table-worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much, much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today, and you can use your promo code Shockwaves for 15% off right now.
All right, we've got Spencer. Spencer, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Of course, man. Thanks for joining us. As I had said at the top of the show, you and I have gotten to know each other over the last couple months. You know, I think I had a lot of people putting your stuff in my face, and they were like, "You got to listen to it. You're gonna love it." And finally, I came around, and I was like, "Yes, I do love it. This is actually great. I want Spencer to be my friend." But no, thank you. You do great work. And as I was telling these guys, the show that I had attended a couple months back was just fantastic. Great energy. Can't wait. You're getting ready to do a show at the Forum, I believe, right?
Yeah, we're going out with a Five Finger Death Punch and Papa Roach.
Oh, okay. Nice. Wow. For those who were not listening, Becca and I were having
prior
a conversation.
Discussion.
We were having a conversation about Papa Roach
Papa
at the Chainsaw Awards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll be there in May. And the only way that I ever heard about the forum was they reference it in Airheads. When Harold Ramis is pretending to be the record executive. He's like, we'll be backstage at the forum in 6 months laughing about this. So.
Yeah. And they say, whose side did you take on the Van Halen split? And he's like, oh, he's a cop.
Van Halen.
Hagar. He's like, he's not legit. Yeah,
that's awesome. That's
I love
awesome.
Airheads.
And you're just Ice Nine Kills is just coming off of a very successful tour.
Yes, we did a headliner, which was incredible, and we played in L.A. at the Belasco, and then we went to Australia and played for about four or five shows.
Amazing.
Right as you know, all the fires were just starting to happen.
Right. And you just recently just did a fundraising campaign, didn't you,
for the
efforts down there?
We released a Freddy Krueger kangaroo shirt.
Yeah.
And we raised like $40,000.
That's fantastic.
Donate. Yeah. Oh,
excellent.
So it was a lot of fun. And they were so nice to us that when we heard about the fires, that that was the least we could do. It's so easy for us to just put up a shirt. So
Does it blow your mind when you go to the far side of the world and people are just into your shit? Like, is that just fucking crazy?
It's insane. We had never been to Australia before, and to hear the crowd like chanting the band name before, and seeing all these people at a regular rock metal festival, but dressed up as Freddie and Jason and Michael. And I don't think they would be dressed up like that if we weren't there. So it's cool to see that kind of stuff.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And do you feel like you're introducing? Because Ryan said at your show that. He noticed he might have been one of the oldest people there.
Did feel very old there, yeah.
But like people going nuts at your riff on the Halloween theme, and it's like maybe you're introducing a lot of the younger people to these characters.
We do see a lot of that. We see a lot of actually families coming, bringing their little kids. And at first, when I started to see that, I was like, oh, that's cool. Like they're dressing up their little kid as like an accessory. That's cute. But the little kids are singing the words to the songs. So I think it's really funny. And I'm talking little kids, like 3 or 4 years old, on their father's shoulders, screaming the words, about a killer clown or murdering a masked intruder.
Wow.
Now, Silver Scream is your fifth album?
Yeah, fifth full-length.
Full-length album, yes. Right. Now, digging into the origins of this particular album, just talk about it. I mean, like, obviously, you have kind of released your kind of horror desires through previous albums and songs, but this one you just kind of went full on.
Exactly. We had always had a horror sort of permeating through everything we did, even when we were more of like a punk ska band. And the record we did before the Silver Scream was called Every Trick in the Book, where it was the first time we did a kind of a conceptual record with every song about a different piece of literature. And a lot of that was horror related. Like we did The Exorcist, we did Carrie. And the reaction to that seemed really strong on that album with the literature. And we heard a lot of people from the fan base saying, oh, well, you should tackle horror. And I was like, that was up next on my list. So it was only the natural progression to go full force into that. And it was just a lot of fun to make, man. These are movies, and this is a culture that I've been into since I was a little kid. So it made the songwriting that much more enjoyable to be like, how do we incorporate, Jason Voorhees or Michael Myers into these songs? It was a trip.
Well, you seem to be having a lot of fun with the stuff surrounding the album's release, the music videos, the merch, how much do you have a hand in all of the kind of extracurricular stuff that's there to promote the album?
Yeah, I'm the sick mind behind all of it, really. And with an album, based on horror films, it was only a natural thing, a natural extension of the album to have a film component. So that was a lot of fun to interject our own narrative within these stories. Mm-hmm. And, the idea came to me, maybe I could play myself, the singer of Ice Nine Kills, because I love that self-referential stuff all the way back from like New Nightmare and Scream. And I thought that would be a cool kind of world to play with, that, Spencer from Ice Nine Kills is visiting a psychiatrist about these dreams that he's having.
And did you shoot, because I was watching, there's like a whole giant arc when you watch all the music videos and stuff like that. Are those, did you do them one at a time and then keep evolving it? Or did you have a basic idea like, all right, it's just going to be the psychiatrist theme the whole way through. Let's shoot as much as we can.
I had a general, arching story over the entire thing. And we filmed like the first two videos together in a set. And then the next sort of one at a time between breaks on tours. But right up to the very last, you know, 2 weeks of editing the last film, I was coming up with like another twist at the ending. And we did a whole other addition to the last video for It Is the End, where we kind of pulled to Arlington Road, if you remember that film, which has a great twist ending where not only does he get killed? I think it's – is it Jeff Bridges?
Jeff Bridges and Tim Robbins?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Not only does he get killed, but his entire legacy is ruined because they blame him and pin, you know, pin the whole explosion on him. So that's where I kind of got that idea.
Nice.
Now, what? Let's go back into your roots, man. Mm-hmm. Like, what was the horror movie that started it all for you?
Yeah,
I got into it very young, very young. My parents were very cool, and I remember they would always tell me the story that they saw Halloween when they went to see Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and it was a double feature, and they went to see Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and a little film that they had no idea about was called Halloween. It was playing before Body Snatchers, and you know, at the time they had never seen anything like that, so it made Invasion seem quite tame afterward. And I remember, you know, my dad and mom saying that they, you know, were looking you know, when they were getting into their car, that, you know, Michael Myers was behind them. So they allowed me to see that movie when I was very young. I must have been 5 or 6. And from there, I just wanted to see all of them. Yeah. And a lot of it started from going to a VHS, you know, video store that was within this supermarket that my mom would buy her groceries at. And I would go there to kill time while she was shopping. And for whatever reason, it wasn't like an older brother and older sister that said, you got to check out horror. I was just drawn to that aisle with the artwork on those VHS tapes of Friday the 13th and Sleepaway Camp. And I was just like, this is what I'm born to be interested in.
And you're East Coast, right?
Yeah, you're Boston?
Yeah, originally from north of Boston.
So maybe that's like a Stop and Shop, because I remember there was an era. Yeah, the Stop and Shop. I used to work at Stop and Shop in my high school years. But in my latter years, they opened up a video store within the grocery store, and there was –
What a wild thing if you think about it now, a video store in – I mean, I guess they sell
– Well, there's
a
Red Boxes
are in grocery stores. Red Box,
I guess. So I remember because we had a 7-Eleven near my house, which then became a Hives and then closed down. But we would walk to the 7-Eleven to rent movies. We had like our mom and pop, which had like the big horror selection. But I remember 7-Eleven
– they would have like a little like section.
Two or three videos. Yeah. Like it was an aisle that they had. So yeah, it was weird. Yeah.
What was your reaction to seeing Halloween? They're like at F5, was it because obviously it fueled a love, but was it initially – Did it create nightmares, fear, or did you instantly just feel something else, something exciting charged through you?
It was a combination of both. I was terrified by it. I remember being scared that, you know, Michael or Jason was under my bed. I would call mom, dad. You know, I would just yell out in the night for them to come and check on me. But I just became obsessed with it and wanted to find the mask and wanted the costume. And at that time, there were no good Michael Myers masks, so I look back at some of the masks that I bought. I was like, this does not look like Michael Myers. It looks like Michael Jackson. And just fell in love with it, and my parents were cool enough to let me experiment and watch these films. And I was always the kid in school telling my friends, you got to watch this movie again. And I kind of got a reputation as, I don't know if you should hang out with him. I remember, and I wish I had saved it in my pre-kindergarten or kindergarten report card, the teacher even referenced the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Spencer has claimed to have seen this film. He keeps talking about it. Did she know that I really had seen it. And then from there, you know, saw all the Halloween, saw all the Friday the 13th, some of the more obscure ones. And whenever I would go to Florida on vacation, it became like a ritual with my cousin and I. After the beach and after dinner, we get to go to Blockbuster and pick out a new horror film. And the next turning point for me was seeing Scream in the theater, because that was the first time I had ever seen one in the theater. Mm-hmm. I'd been a huge fan of slasher films, but you know, when I got into that movie and then I see the killer referencing Michael and Jason in that first scene, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be my favorite movie of all time. Mm-hmm. And it was really scary to me, that first scene especially. I think I was under the seats.
Wow. Yeah. Well, considering your love of the genre growing up, and obviously you eventually found a very creative outlet, was there ever any thought or debate about maybe getting into movies because of your love of it? Or was music always kind of the thing that you gravitated towards?
I think that I, you know, not just horror I'm obsessed with. I'm obsessed with all film, and I've always been the guy in my group that memorizes all the dialogue and that can spout all this shit out, even when my friends are saying, like, all right, Spencer, stop quoting a line from, you know, Halloween 5 or something. No one knows what the hell you're talking about. But it seemed more feasible to make music at the time because I was so young and in high school. And I'm glad to say that with how the band evolved into horror, I was able to kind of fulfill that other passion, which is film, and kind of make our own within our musical universe.
Now, had you always been a metal fan as well, or did that evolve too?
I originally was more into kind of punk music, like the SoCal Epitaph record scene and bands like Goldfinger and Less Than Jake and NoFX and all that stuff. But I always loved heavy music as well. I loved Metallica. I remember seeing them on, I think, the Load album cycle in Boston, and, you know, where the Bruins play. And as the band progressed, I think I slowly started to slip into heavier music, and our sound is really a combination of all those influences, going back from punk to all the way to death metal, and also Broadway musicals like Les Mis and Phantom. It's kind of a combination of all
that's
that.
What I noticed. Like, it reminded me, I felt Dream Theater as I was listening to it. Okay, I'm glad, because that it's this, I don't want to call it Broadway metal, but it's this very melodic, and I think it's actually called melodic core, but I can't keep up with all the cores. So there's a lot of cores.
It sounds like you need to watch Phantom of the Paradise. That seems to be the movie that would be for you then.
I don't think I know that.
Okay.
Oh, really? Brian De Palma's rock musical.
Rock musical. With the star.
We had a conversation about this.
Oh, this
Star of Suspiria is in it. Yeah. Jessica Harper's Star of Suspiria is the lead. Yeah. So this movie, I think you need in your life.
Yeah. 80s or?
70s. Late 70s.
Yeah. I think I got my film for tonight.
I think you're going to have a blast with that.
It's great.
We were talking about Stage Fright as well.
Stage Fright.
Oh, so good. One of my favorite Jello films. I love that one.
No. We were talking about this is the newer Stage Fright.
Oh, the musical one.
I had such a good time with that. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, where it was like the girl goes to the band camp or the singing camp, and then there's the killer that's wearing a kabuki mask, and he sings metal, and she sings very beautiful melodic music.
It had its issues, but I had a blast
watching
that.
Yeah, I had
Minnie
fun.
Driver, I think.
Minnie Driver. Meatloaf.
Yeah.
Meatloaf.
Yeah. Meatloaf. Yeah. Got a cameo in it.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about writing process because I love music as well. But, you know, how early did the horror component make its way into your music, into the band's music? Was that always a prevalent thing, or slowly?
It was slow. It always sort of reared its head with song titles that were sort of tongue-in-cheek and had some, you know, bloody lyrical content within the albums. Even before we really delved into a full horror thing, a lot of our merchandise was, you know, references to my favorite horror franchises, and a little bit with some of the music videos. But the Silver Scream really was the first time we were like, this is a horror band. Let's go for it. And I remember, you know, there were some naysayers, not with a malicious intent, but saying like, I don't know if horror, that's going to really work. And I know it's a popular genre, but does it translate with music? And I just kind of said, I don't really care. It's just going to be fun. And I think the fun sort of permeates through the music. You could tell that it was an enjoyable thing to put together.
And have the fans kind of embrace the horror edge of it?
Oh, yeah. It's really cool to see. And Ryan being at the show, you know, you saw – you put it really beautifully. You said it was like the church of horror.
No, because you go in – let me just explain it. I mean, you go in and there is that kind of Green Band trailer copy you see where it's like it looks like the MPAA logo on it. And that's over the curtain. And then once the curtain rises, every kid in there fucking loses their goddamn mind. But then there's just like – there are pockets of the stage that are all – that all have their own theme. There are three microphones. One has – you know, the red balloons from it. Yeah. One has kind of a shining edge to it. Spencer's is all sorts of stuff. But, you know, and then there's like a kind of a jigsaw element. There's a Michael Myers element. And it's like just an amalgamation of all of this iconic horror imagery, and it just blends so well. And it's just like a, just a big celebration of the genre. You can't like not love it. It's great,
which Thank is cool you. Because yeah. metal in general. Like growing up, it's like I loved Iron Maiden, and I would just stare at those album covers with Eddie, and then Megadeth, and trying to find like why it they were like that close to the horror thing, and yet they never really melded it. Whereas it seems like you have with every aspect of the band and the show and all that.
Could you talk a little bit about your stage shows? Because that's something that I always loved so much about metal, like growing up with Alice Cooper, and then I got to work with GWAR, and now, I mean, Ryan and I have been to see Ghost a dozen
Ghost
times.
King Diamond recently.
King Diamond, so how you kind of like plan out your stage shows?
Definitely going to shows like Rob Zombie when I was a very young kid and seeing that larger than life sort of stuff with the animatronics that he would do and dancers and fire, all that really influenced me. And when you're doing a tour where you're not the featured attraction, you're opening for a larger band or something, you don't really get to do a lot of the production. But so this fall tour that we just finished, wrapped up, that was like the first time that we could really put some money into making it a real show. And I kind of always just go at everything with the band. What would I want to see as a fan? And it's a lot of fun. Obviously, there's like a cheesy kind of element to it, but that's part of the genre, and that's why I love it. And everything from ordering costumes and searching out the perfect knife that looks real but isn't. Some of them end up being real. It's just a really exciting process, and we had a 2 or 3 day pre-production tour meeting where we went through a bunch of choreography. We actually have an actress that tours with us that also does the makeup, and she plays everyone from Mrs. Voorhees to Laurie Strode to Reagan from The Exorcist. And we kind of just put it together as we went through the tour and learned what worked and what didn't. We brought in a lighting guy for the first time who actually had worked on some productions of Les Miserables and Phantom. Mm. So he brought with him a real sense of lighting and cues. And it was a lot of fun. We had like low rising fog that kind of would sit right on the ground, sort of if you've ever seen Phantom of the Opera when he's rowing the boat, you know, it gives you the illusion that he's on the water, but it's just fog. And it was just a lot of a really, as he said, a celebration of the genre and trying to elevate the musical cues with some real live action and a lot of costume changes. I'm running back and forth, switching from Michael to Jason to everyone in between.
Now, when you hatched this album and you were looking at the titles that you were going to tackle, what were the films that you wanted to but just couldn't crack the song?
It really was an issue of time. It began an issue to be an issue of time and how many songs, movies could we fit into one album. Yeah. I think at one point I had a list of maybe 50 that I thought would work well. But I didn't want to do too many similar stories. And if we did, you know, Jason and Michael have, you know, it's not exactly similar, but from a an outsider perspective, it's a similar sort of slasher.
It's a formula.
Yeah, it's a formula. But that's when I said, well, okay, well, let's distinguish this in a way like, you know, this will be from the perspective of Michael, but let's do Friday the 13th from the perspective of the dead counselors to try to give it that differentiation. But there were definitely some films that I would have loved to tackle that maybe, you know, maybe we'll see a silver screen part two.
Yeah.
American Psycho, My Bloody Valentine.
Didn't American Psycho get a musical?
It did.
At one point,
I'd be very curious to see how that
– I saw it.
You saw it?
It was a big failure, but I loved it.
Okay,
I
think cool, yeah.
Music by Duncan Sheik.
Okay, but no Huey Lewis? Did they put Huey – did that joke still
I'm
get in
I'm
sure
there? That was in there. Yeah. I can't really –
that's in the book. That's one of my favorite parts of the
– It was so cool, and I just remember going into that theater. I saw it in New York, and you walk in, and the stage is set up like his apartment.
Yeah.
And it's that, you know, very, you know, I don't know, it's Beethoven or something playing. And I was just like, for 2 hours, just like, this is amazing. And then I looked to my sister, like, this is the worst musical I've ever seen. But I really enjoyed it.
I really wanted to go.
Yeah, I want to see it
too. I love horror musicals so much. Anytime that they do, like I saw the Carrie one last year, I have such a blast.
So here's
with
my
this.
Thing. This is a very interesting. You know, Carrie. Because I worked on Broadway just for like a millisecond in my life, like a little blip on the radar. And I remember Carrie being the thing that, like, whenever it's like, oh, right, you like horror movies. I'm like, yeah. They're like, well, you're too young to have seen the Carrie musical. But when back in my day, I was there for that fateful opening night.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, tell me all. And it became kind of like this, almost like this kind of weird urban legend.
It still is like an urban legend.
But how? But it's funny because now they brought it back many times, and it's been exploited to death. Like, I remember we were doing Happy Death Day pickups on the UCLA campus, and they were doing like a Carrie musical revival. Mm-hmm. But I just love – someone should do a book, Becca. About just horror musicals, like the stage productions.
There's a few standouts. Like Reanimator is great, obviously.
Mm-hmm. I saw The Silence of the Lambs.
The Silence one is great.
Well, there's the Fly Opera.
That one
directed by Cronenberg.
Not so great, though. Yeah.
So for when I was doing my master's degree, we had to write like a script. And since it was in like a theater thing, I did a musical version of Howard the Duck. Which I have sitting somewhere.
Instant F.
All right.
Sorry, Becca, don't even read it.
My open song was called Welcome to Cleveland. Wow. And I was so proud of it. Yeah. And then when we had Roy on the show.
Boobs.
You know that Tyson Hart, the writers of Howard the Duck, also wrote Messiah of Evil.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah. And directed Messiah of
Evil.
They're
like
how
inspirational. And then when we had Roy on the show years ago when he was on Killer POV, I pulled him aside and I was like, I just want you to know that I have this pipe dream of writing a stage musical version of Street Trash.
That I'd go see.
And one day you and I are going to make this happen. And he just laughed and walked away. And I was like, come on, man.
Spencer, yeah. Spencer, you do the music.
Penis throwing.
Spencer, Street Trash the musical. Let's do this.
Singing as you're melting. That'd be pretty cool.
Penises a fly.
I am into this. It feels so theatrical already. The whole thing is staged. It's like Cats, but like with the junkyard. But it's also Street Trash.
I smell a Tony.
I think so. Severed penises.
Has anybody go see Beetlejuice? Spencer, did you see Beetlejuice?
No, I never saw it. Was it great?
Yeah, it was completely different. I saw it this past summer. It was completely different from the movie, but they actually turn it into a joke where at the very beginning, because it opens with her mom dying, which happens in the movie, but it's happened long ago. And then she sings a song called Dead Mom. And then Beetlejuice emerges and does jokes about how this is going to be nothing like the movie, people. and it isn't. It goes completely left field from there. The music is great. I don't even know if Danny Elfman. The whole staging is still as Tim Burton as you can get. Like, that's still stripes and the green and the spiral patterns. Like, it's still just this kaleidoscopic Tim Burton aesthetics overflowing. But the music does not feel very Danny Elfman.
I love Elfman.
Yeah.
He's fantastic.
Yeah. But it's by a guy named Eddie Perfect, composer. Yeah. Is that?
The music, it's still great.
Name.
It's so weird.
Yeah. It's a good name. Well, like, Eddie Money, I'm Eddie Perfect.
I think it's closing in June. I think they have
really? It's been at the Winter Garden, which is one of the smaller Broadway theaters, but it's still because of that, like when the sandworms take over the stage, like you feel like you're way up on there. I took Marnie this summer and she loved it.
Wow.
It was a trip.
When we were in New York over the holiday break, we walked by it and I looked at it and I looked at the guy who's playing Beetlejuice and I was like, me to just remove.
Get Michael Keaton.
It's Michael Keaton.
It's Michael Keaton. It's not.
And then we walked by a picture of Lydia, and I was like, it's so hard because it's not Winona Ryder.
So they're so both hard for me. Really good, but they are not the movie. They definitely make ways to kind of separate it.
Yeah, I guess, too, it's like the Beetlejuice cartoon came out after my time. I was too old for that. So I guess it's kind of like you just have to have that disconnect.
Yeah,
you know?
You got to accept
it. I remember watching the first episode of the Beetlejuice cartoon. I was like, nope.
It's fun. I watched the Beetlejuice cartoon.
Well, I know I'm like isolating a mass audience right now that grew up on that cartoon.
Yeah, Lydia red dress. That was definitely my jam.
I saw The Exorcist in London. That wasn't a musical.
The Exorcist stage play?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I didn't know.
I was really excited about it, but it kind of fell a little bit flat. It had sort of a campy element that doesn't really work The Exorcist.
It's the Leslie Nielsen one.
Repossessed.
That's a great
one. That is funny.
Blair's in that one.
Yes, she is. It's hilarious.
I'm a big Leslie Nielsen fan. I was just watching Creepshow with him reminded of how great that episode is.
All the Naked Guns. I was curious about, because all the characters from, at least from this particular album, are based on like our classic icon monsters. What about contemporary horror? What are some of the types of films that you're getting, you know, that are keeping you fueled with the love of horror? Like, I know for us, we do our top 10 of the decade. We do our top 10 of the year. What is the stuff that keeps you excited in theaters, the new stuff?
I would say like over the last 20 years, I'm a big slasher guy. Mm-hmm. So I really did like the first Hatchet. I thought the gore in that movie was exceptional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just the use of the practical effects was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I love the new Halloween. I know we're at Blumhouse. That was great.
Thanks.
And, today's episode, Rich.
And another Blumhouse, Happy Death Day, which I love the element of the Groundhog's Day.
Yeah, yeah. That's really cool. That's cool
really
movie,
cool.
Yeah.
I enjoyed – I liked both It and It Chapter 2. I know there's a lot of mixed emotions and feelings about the second one, but – although it was a bit long, I really did enjoy it and thought that opening scene just kind of knocked you over the head.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a really serious question?
Sure.
Okay. Should there be a remake of Nightmare, another remake of Nightmare, or should we just let it lay?
Only if Robert Englund is attached.
I'm with you. It's like,
it's you guys like don't think that another person could think, ever assume the role?
I think you know, so. As you said, with Michael Keaton and Beetlejuice, this is even another step further. Yeah. It's like you can't really do it without Robert Englund. He is that character.
But it would be fun to see him in that costume one more time. I could really get into that personally.
Yeah,
I don't want a reinvention of that particular type of story for some reason. You know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
See, I'm glad we got to that.
Yeah. But he
you
jumped.
You were the expert I needed to
He totally jumped. I still had one more – like metal music horror musical question. I'm doubling back really quick. 2000, it was quite possibly my favorite Broadway movement. I saw Sebastian Bach from Skid Row as Jekyll and Hyde.
Wow.
In Jekyll and
I remember
and
that.
Hyde.
Oh my God.
It was fucking brilliant. Okay, we can move on from horror music.
Yeah. Sounds cool.
And we did a song about Jekyll and Hyde on the Every Chick in the Book album. It's called Me, Myself, and Hyde.
Oh, awesome.
That was actually sort of the first song we ever did about a book or about a film, and it sort of bridged the gap to what we would become as far as tackling songs with, you know, multiple characters. I mean, to do a song with multiple personalities, like, that's such a cool way to go back and forth between the singing and the screaming, and that's what drew me to doing that.
Huh.
Well, in particular with these last two albums, since they're kind of like based on things, what's the writing process like? Is it lyrics first, then music, music and lyrics? Like, I always find that for me, the process always changes.
Yes.
Sometimes it's just a melody, and it's like, what words will fit in that melody? So what is it like for you? Do you have to work backwards from lyrics once you're like, well, this is going to be Thank God It's Friday about Friday 13th?
It's funny. It does work, as you said, in a few different ways. But, you know, take Thank God It's Friday. I actually found the voice memo on my phone when I was playing at the piano. Drowning all our sins, and my girlfriend's listening, and she goes, I think you're onto something, baby. And I just had that, you drown in our sins, you know, he drowned in our mistakes, and then kind of went from there. And I always find the chords and the melodies first, and then sort of have kind of dummy lyrics and dummy patterns, and then go back and put the lyrics to those. Mm-hmm. Me and another guy, Steve Sopcak, we write all the lyrics, and it's just so fun to sit with him in a room and bounce ideas off of each other. And it's like putting together a puzzle, really, because we have very similar styles of writing, that we love puns and we love plays on words, and it's just a lot of fun.
And then does that go to like – a demo of you on the piano figuring out the basics go to the rest of the band to figure out what everyone else is going to do? Or is there a little bit of a collaboration between
him? It's more collaborative at the end of the process. Actually, the song we did most recently about Scream, Your Number's Up, me and two of the guys just kind of sat there when the process was already at having the melody and some of the lyrics of the intro, and then kind of putting it together as a puzzle, you know, which parts are going to be heavy, which parts are going to be more melodic. But it usually starts off in a very stripped down format with either just a guitar and a melody that I've come up with, or some sort of screaming pattern, and then sort of weaving the characters and lyrics is the last piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. I'm not as familiar with your early stuff, but was it harder or easier to kind of have that, like, that influence? Like, all right, this is about Friday the 13th. So, you know, like, all right, that's what I'm honing in on, as opposed to like, what am I emotionally feeling right now?
Right.
What should I write about?
It was definitely easier in the sense that we had the story there. You know, we know what's happening, and we know a lot about the character. But the harder part was, you know, we want these songs to live up to how great the films were. So yeah. That was always in the back of my mind, like, does this do Michael Myers justice? But I would say as a whole, it was a really interesting and in a lot of ways easier way to write a song, because you don't have to think, what am I feeling today? You know?
Yeah.
It was more like, what's my favorite slasher movie right now? We always had the movies on in the background,
yeah.
To just kind of color that extra inspiration. The movie Going to Pieces, that
that's a good one.
That's just a great sort of reel of all the, you know, all the hits. So
yeah.
To speak.
Yeah. What do you have when you're out on tour? What are the movies that are your kind of comfort? What's your comfort food? What's your security blanket horror movies that you have?
Wow. Well, I tend to, on the road, explore a lot of like the bonus features on stuff. Yeah. So a lot of documentaries like His Name Was Jason, which it was funny. I texted you. I was watching. I was like, I didn't know you were in this, Ryan. That's cool.
I think we all were.
Yeah. You know, the Halloween documentaries, I think it was 20 Years of Terror. Mm-hmm. Like I like delving into a lot of that stuff. And I try to bring out titles that I haven't watched in a while. Like I remember brought The Prowler out on the last run, and just watching the bonus features with, like, you know, Tom Savini just being an awesome, sick guy, creating some stuff.
Is the rest of your band is into horror, or do you annoy them with it on tour?
I definitely annoy them with it. I've sort of slowly brought them into my dark world, and they appreciate it, but they a couple of them who like horror tend to go a little bit more of the highbrow stuff, when I like the sleazy slasher crap.
Nice.
That's my bread and butter.
There's room for both.
There is.
What is your favorite Friday film? Because when you say sleazy, I'm thinking five.
Five. All the actresses were porn stars, right? Yeah.
There should be like wait a minute, hold on. This should almost be rapid fire, Elric. I think you're on a roll here.
Well, what's your
favorite Friday?
Man, I a lot of people go with six. That is one of my favorite, but I would say probably two, because you get Jason and you get him in an interesting sack head form. But it's like picking, you know, my favorite child. I don't have any children, but
yeah. Two is a great slasher film. It's just a great slasher film.
I remember my girlfriend and I broke into the Camp Nobe Bosco, which was really cool, because we just couldn't get in. You know, I called pretending I was like a Boy Scout leader, because it's a Boy Scout camp. They saw through that pretty quickly. Least favorite, Jason Takes Manhattan. Yeah. But, you know, I'm a weird guy. I like I like Jason Goes to Hell. I like Halloween 6. Like,
all right, I was going to say, what's your favorite Halloween sequel after Halloween 2?
After Halloween 2.
Man, are we counting so 3?
You can't count 3 because it's not a
Michael Myers.
We can't count 3.
Why are these rules?
It's hard.
I know. I don't like the rules.
These are the tough questions.
I kind of want to I always want to Frankenstein certain things. Like, I wish that, you know, I've grown to like them, like, accept, I'll say, The Mask in 4 and 5. But when I was a kid and I saw those masks, I was like, what is going on with Michael?
Well, 5.
Yeah. But I would say, you said after 2?
After 2.
I would say 4 because of some of Loomis's dialogue in that one is just so good.
Yeah.
If his mask was just a little better, that one would be so much more well regarded. Like, I like 4. I think 4 is a really
fun
one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the next tough question. Nightmare on Elm Street 4 and 5. Do they hold up? Yes or no?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
I have mixed feelings on it. You know, when I rewatched the what was the retrospective that they did? The
Nightmare Legacy.
Legacy. I'm drawn to watch those films again. But for me, other than the first one and New Nightmare, I think is my favorite. Yeah. So the other ones are a little. Sometimes I find myself falling asleep. No pun intended.
Micro naps.
Exactly. And I mean, for me, New Nightmare, I think is probably my favorite. Other than the first one. What about you?
Do I think Nightmare 4 and 5 hold up? No.
No.
Four's still fun.
Four's fun.
No, I'm sorry, guys.
I don't hate 5.
I find that as I get older, they're becoming more of a struggle, so I just kind of lean back to Nightmare. I actually lean back to Nightmare 2.
I like 3.
Wow.
Nightmare 2 more than
3. Yeah, 3
is like 1, 2. It goes like 1, 2, 3, New Nightmare. All right, here's the next question. Post Scream, what is the best slasher?
post Scream. Wow, yeah. That's
best teen slasher post Scream.
That is a tough.
That's
one.
That's a tough one. Let me think on that
I'm
for
trying
a second.
To think what came out after that?
I always think of if Scream was Halloween. I always think of sort of I Know What You Did Last Summer as the Friday the 13th.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Totally, totally.
Because it just came right in its wake. Yeah. I really liked Urban Legend when it came out. I saw it in the theater. It was really cool. But I think if I had to go with one, probably the My Bloody Valentine remake. I thought that was really cool.
Pretty solid.
Okay. Yeah.
I thought it didn't pretend to be something it wasn't. It was schlocky. The acting was campy. But the kills were so brutal that it kind of gave me what I wanted in the Friday the 13th remake. Although I think Jason Mears is a great Jason.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted more brutal kills. Mm-hmm. Don't cut away at the first kill.
Yeah.
Come on.
What about you guys?
We can go into that a little bit. I don't know. But you know what? Just a sidebar, My Bloody Valentine, Ryan and I texted about this week. Years ago, Lionsgate put out like kind of a cobbled together director's cut of the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the footage was pretty rough, but you could still tell. I don't know how they found it, but Scream Factory found like the original negative.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a YouTube clip of they restored all the gore and it looks perfect now.
I mean, it's beautifully color graded and all of the.
Finally getting a pristine, uncut version of the original.
So wow. That's awesome. Remember when he was on our show, he seemed really sad that we'd never probably see that.
Somebody had it.
Wow.
Somebody had it.
That's
somebody
great.
Always has it. Yeah. That's
great. Another sidebar that I want a tangential conversation is just a shout. Just a mention that the writer of Urban Legend, Silvio Horta, took his own life this week. It wasn't a show that I watched regularly, but he was part of a show.
A big
Silvio
popular
one,
not Pose, but like
doing a terrible job with this.
I'm looking it up now.
I didn't realize he was part of Urban Legend.
Ugly
Betty, which was a cool show.
But and it was nice to see that Urban Legend was getting dropped in a lot of the mentioned, I should say, in a lot of the obituaries and stuff like that.
That's cool.
Really sad.
Such
really
a
sad
shame.
To see him taken. Yeah. I'm trying to think of another. I had another rapid fire question and I blanked.
Also, Silent Night, Deadly Night, the original is one of my favorites. It's just so goddamn funny. And the part where he's like, when he's like, oh, that was Father O'Brien. The police officer said he yelled. Well, he's deaf.
He's deaf, yeah. That's one of my favorite reveals.
Yeah.
Who does all of the kind of impersonations and voices and stuff like that in the tracks? Like the old grandpa in the sound.
That was me.
Was that you?
that was me. You better run for your life. You know, they pitched it down. I also got to do an impression of Ralph. You're all doomed.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then my good friend, Andrew Smith, who's I've always just, when we were friends back in the day, my father always would say, he's got a great voice for radio. He just had this like loud booming voice of like an opera singer when he was 8. And he does a lot of the voiceover too, like the Jigsaw kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Oh, my other rapid fire question. Favorite rock movie soundtrack, whether it's The Crow or what I was listening to today. And you can chime in on whether it's good or not.
Uh-oh.
Freddy versus Jason.
Right. That has
I took a ride into work this morning and listened to the Freddy versus Jason soundtrack.
I don't know if there's a more 2003, 2004 soundtrack than Freddy versus Jason.
I think my body was literally transported to 2003.
Mine's Demon Knight. Or even though it's not horror in any capacity, I would say the why can't I remember it? Emilio Estevez trying to get out of downtown.
Judgment Night!
One of the best, greatest soundtracks of all time. Yes, and all those great Sonic Youth and the Cypress Hill.
Soundtrack. But I would also say Demon Knight.
Demon Knight
was lost that. Yeah. We do not have the soundtrack component for horror films
anymore. Also because they don't sell soundtracks
in the same way. Remember Spawn? Yeah. They tried to do it with Spawn. Yeah, also like the metal, the new metal
electronic. Shout out to my wife, one of her favorites.
They do it. I remember the Transformers movie had like the Great Divide song attached to it. But
there was like that. Those were like singles, you know. But full Flesh and Blood rock movie soundtracks. Last Action Hero was a great one.
I love that movie. Yeah. I mean, that's like the scream of those movies. Yeah. It's just so
fun. Or even also, like Nightmare 3. I mean,
Dokken,
like,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, and Scream did that for horror as well, because I remember buying the Scream soundtrack with all the songs, and I remember anxiously awaiting the Scream 2 soundtrack, even though it had some terrible rap music on it.
Yeah, it was like Master P.
Yeah.
But for first, the first soundtrack for Scream was great. The Bird Brain song, you know, all the dead kids lying on the floor.
Yeah.
And we actually, when we went to the Scream house for the Scream Comes Home event, the band performed acoustic that Bird Brain song in the garage.
Wow. Oh, that's cool.
Wow.
So that was really cool.
That's cool. Gosh. Yeah, there were so many good ones. And I remember, like, it's kind of petered out after a while. And I think – and it's funny, too, with the, you know, with the advent of Spotify, you could find some of them on there. But a lot of these soundtracks are really hard to come by unless you go to Amoeba. Like, I remember having, like, this kind of urge to just re-listen to the Strange Days soundtrack with Peter Gabriel and all these kind of, like, weird synthy Enya type shit. And I was like, I really like that stuff. But I couldn't just type in Strange Days soundtrack on Spotify, because I'm sure there's some sort of legal – you know, like licensing thing.
Yeah, that's, for all those songs.
Like, they kind of broke all of that kind of those deals
and
up.
Yeah, often they're on YouTube somehow. Like, people play whole albums on YouTube. Yeah. That's how I listen to a lot of stuff.
But we don't have that, like, song connect. Like, I think, like, oh, that song. That's the Caddyshack 2 song right there. And we have that ever. It was like it was a Kenny Loggins song. I like
Spencer's going into Caddyshack.
I like Caddyshack 2.
One I remember is, like, that Evanescence song for Daredevil. Remember,
Wake
like, that
me
was,
up
like,
inside.
That was, like, when was the last time, like, a band catapulted to success from a soundtrack?
Amy, I can't remember her last name, but yeah, she's just like a goddess in general. So.
Drowning Pool with Jason X, let the bodies hit the floor. That was
that was badass.
Which became like
the anthem,
standard horror trailer material.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
But she's Drowning Pool. Put your bodies in the floor. Let's do it.
I remember they used that in Jet Li's The One.
Oh, really?
Which was like, I fucking love Jet Li's The One. With Jason Statham, where it's just Jet Li trying to take out Multiverse Jet Li's Becca multiverse Whoa. Movie.
Multiverse movie with Jason Statham. You're just hitting all the sweet spots right there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it was so funny. I was walking out of a Target the other day, and when I saw this, this woman walking out with the Evanescence album.
And
that was it.
That's your punchline?
No, that's a, and I just looked at it and was like, oh, okay, cool. I'm glad that album is still selling. I didn't know. I thought after a while, like the Wake Me Up Inside song, it just like kind of slipped into obscurity after downloading
it.
Yeah,
it's a great jam.
I still listen
if you're that person, I'm sorry.
I don't know. I like to revisit this. Like, I still have My Chemical Romance on my phone, and often I'm like, yes, I'm joining the Black Parade, people. It's happening.
That's great.
Spencer, what are your embarrassing music moments?
What's your
guilty pleasures?
I tend to gravitate towards some Disney material. I mean,
hell yes,
but I have a mix.
I'm up here. Thank you.
I do have mixed feelings about it, because the band was actually banned from a venue because it was owned by Disney.
Are you serious?
Whoa. Yeah. So we
you're not going to get to play Downtown Disney anytime soon.
We were booked to play at the Orlando House of Blues, and I get a call from our agent about a month before the tour saying, listen, they found your music to be a little bit off color. I don't know how they put it.
Get out of here.
I got my Disney horror shirt on tonight, which no one else recognizes.
Oh, no, Disney, Halloween trees.
Disney horror shirt.
So instead of, you know, pissing and moaning about it, I just kind of thought, oh, this is kind of cool. So we just put out a whole line of shirts featuring, you know, Donald Duck as Georgie. We had Mickey Mouse as Freddy Krueger. We had I think we had Goofy as Leatherface, and our lawyer was like, well, you're going to get a cease and desist.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're tempting fate there.
Because they're so stringent about their intellectual property.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we never heard from them, and it was the best-selling line of shirts we ever had.
I One of those.
I will absolutely get you one.
A couple of years ago on my Instagram, this shirt popped up and it was Donald Duck's face, like the traditional Donald Duck, but he had a predator mouth.
Oh.
And I immediately was like, where is this? I must find this. And I was never able to find it. And I then found a couple of months later, there was a Winnie the Pooh Cenobite line that came out and it sold out so quickly. But yeah.
Well, we're leaning.
Disney horror.
I was going to say, we're leaning into clothing design. Spencer, you have your own clothing company.
That's correct.
What is that?
So I have a company called Cleaver, which is based in Salem. That's where I lived before I came and moved out to LA. And what's ironic about it is we were banned from Salem for one October because they didn't like some of our designs when we sold them on the at the street fair that they have every October. So I thought it was kind of ironic that, you know, have we not learned from the historical injustices? We're casting us out just like they cast the witches out of town. So the next year we submitted under a different name, and the guy had a conniption when we got there, and I smooth talked him, and now he allows us to sell.
Good.
But yeah, it's cool. You know, I always loved growing up and seeing bands. You know, even in my punk days, like Blink, those guys would have their own clothing lines, and you know, I wanted to be like those guys, so I wanted to buy it. So I thought it would be cool to have that, but more of a horror centric thing. And we do a lot of the festival circuits, and I love that time of year in October when we get to do things like Rock and Shock and Worcester and the other kind of festivals. And it's just a lot of fun to be part of that culture.
Yeah. And is that a venture that you have partners in, you design and yourself and all that jazz?
It's me and another guy that works with the merchandise with the band. He actually tours with us.
Yeah.
And now we're getting involved with our management company, 10th Street, and they're going to sort of be a partner for it as well.
That's
so
cool.
I'm excited to see where we can take it.
Nice.
Yeah. So if anyone wants anything, Salem666.com. We've got some stuff that'll get you expelled or deported.
Well, I was going to say, anybody who's seen my Instagram and seen the Freddy Krueger sneakers that I wear.
Oh, yes.
Those are from Cleaver.
Those look good on you.
They look great, man. Thank you.
No problem.
I mean, like, people lose their minds when they see those. So what's the future hold? Are you going back? You're obviously playing the Forum, but does that kick off a whole new tour? Are you going to be busy all the rest of the year?
We're doing a cruise, actually, February 1st through 6th, called Shiprocked. And it's a bunch of bands that get on this cruise. Hopefully it ends up a little bit better than Jason Takes Vancouver.
Or Jason, yeah.
That was revealing. I had Poseidon Adventure in my mind. You said
I was going Deep Rising.
It's like boom, boom, boom. Yeah. Ghost Ship. Who has Ghost Ship?
But
I'm going to go Triangle.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I like Triangle. Yeah, okay.
That works. Yeah. So that should be interesting. Yeah. And then we head overseas with Papa Roach and Hollywood Undead to a number of places we've been overseas, but also another number of places we've never been. Like, I've never been to Spain. I've never been to Italy. So we're playing a lot of kind of crazy places.
Nice.
And then back to the States for the Five Finger Death Punch Papa Roach tour. And then from there, we go to England for a few dates, then Russia and the Ukraine.
That's awesome.
So a lot.
Have you ever been on a cruise ship?
No, I don't think I have. I mean, I think the only sort of large-scale ship I've ever been on was when we toured overseas, and between you know, getting to some of the different places, I think from France to one of the other locations, we had to take some sort of a large cruise ship that took our bus into it. And
whoa,
yeah,
that's awesome.
That's pretty cool.
Sounds like a bunch of firsts for you.
Yeah, it should be really cool.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Well, I think it seems like this. The Silver Scream is probably a really good starting point.
Absolutely,
if you're new to them. And,
yeah,
and I'm noticing on the web store that you have kind of like a CD DVD packet that comes in what looks like a VHS tape. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's kind of neat.
We work with this artist named Mike Cortati, does a lot of our artwork, and he has a love for the slasher sort of retro VHS thing like I do, and we put together a really cool package where in this re-release of the album called The Final Cut, you get the movie in DVD form, you get a little documentary that we shot at the Scream House, and some really other cool little treats, and some bonus content. One in particular is really cool. We did our song, Thank God It's Friday, about Friday the 13th, and we did an acoustic version. And Ari Lehman, who plays the original Jason, sings on
who's
the track.
Who's himself a musician, yeah.
Who is a great musician.
I've seen him play horror conventions before.
First Jason. So he came out to see us in Chicago, and you know, we got him backstage passes. He's up in the balcony, and there's a part at the end of the song where it goes into like that Harry Manfredini nice element at the end where you think the movie's over. And I just look up at the balcony, like, everyone make some noise for the real Jason. And the crowd went wild, and he came backstage after the show, and he was just really cool. And like, you guys are the future horror metal. And we're like, are we really hanging out with Jason? He said, that was cool.
Well, that's cool. Well, Spencer, good luck on the rest of your journey this year and traveling, and have fun. Make the most of it.
Watch Phantom of the Paradise while
you're on
Phantom
tour.
Watch
Phantom of the Paradise.
That's my homework.
The whole thing is about music and horror.
Slasher.
And,
it's also
and
a slasher.
Kind of,
you'll love it.
And entry-level rock. It's very glam rocky.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. The guy who writes the Muppet movies. What's the
it's,
little guy?
Paul
Rudd?
No.
Paul Bertel. He's little too, though. And he is in the Halloween film.
Halloween 6.
I know.
He's one of the most famous. The guy does all the songs for the Muppets. He's one of the most famous lyricists. He's in it. He's like,
great.
He's the star of it. He's playing a famous musician. Yeah. I can't believe
remember. Phil Nobile is going
to we're going to get
Paul Williams.
Paul Williams is in the movie. So.
I will check that out 100%.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Looking forward to seeing you back in L.A.
Absolutely. If you guys want tickets, just let me know.
Hey.
Hell yeah.
Looking forward to a song based on Happy Death Day. I think you've got that.
That would be really cool.
I think that's going to happen.
I want a song called Shockwaves.
Oh, hey.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
We'll do the intro music.
Could be our new theme song.
We can take it. Yeah, cool. There is a Floridian
horror film called Shockwaves. So you got that. You know?
Yeah, but it's about Nazis. Don't put that in there.
Okay, we'll leave out the
Nazis. Leave out the Nazis.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. That goes a long way. And we will see you next week.
See you then. See you underwater in theaters.
Get your tickets for Panic Fest.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Danier, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Sapova-Mare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pacetta, and Rob Galuzzo.